Many people in our food community have been seriously impacted by Superstorm Sandy, and our hearts go out to them. At HRN, we've been covering these stories since the storm hit. To learn more, visit our website at www.heritageradionetwork.org. Today's program has been brought to you by Whole Foods Market, a dynamic leader in the quality food business, a mission-driven company that aims to set the standards of excellence for food retailers. For more information, visit wholefoodsmarket.com. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
We Dig Plants on the Heritage Radio Network. We're Groundworks, Inc. I'm Alice Marcus Krieg.
And I'm Carmen DeVito.
And we design, install, and maintain gardens in and around New York City. We Dig Plants brings the culture to horticulture. And in doing so, today we're going to talk about one of my favorite obsessions, and I know Carmen's too, David Austin roses.
Yes.
Each winter, they produce this amazing slick green catalog that comes in the mail. And you get to dream again about summer, and you get to remember those amazing colors and fragrances and the optimism that roses bring. It's really a blending of old and modern times, in particular with these roses.
And we could use some optimism here in New York, especially. We've had rough couple of weeks, and we really missed coming into the studio. But
last week
and the week before, it was really, really impossible.
But the gas lines are going down.
Yes.
And that's good. The subways are kind of up and running again for the most part, and electricity is flowing again. So.
And roses are blooming again.
Yeah, actually they are. In fact, my rose in my front garden in Brooklyn put out a new flush in this today spring weather. So in the last 3 weeks, we've had tropical storm, hurricane, fall. Then we had winter, we had snow, and now we have a beautiful spring day today. So let's talk about roses.
Can I tell you the last thing I did before I sort of battened the hatches, Alice, at my house?
You stopped and smelled the roses?
No, well, I stopped and picked the roses. I said, God damn it, I'm not going to let Sandy take my roses.
Yeah,
so
exactly.
I picked a whole bunch of these roses, and I brought them in. And then I battened the hatches.
Yeah, right. And sat and dreamed about the roses.
And waited.
So we have an amazing guest today. We have the Rosarian and the technical manager of David Austin Rose Company, Michael Marriott. He's our guest today, calling in from England. And he's going to tell us about the history of the company and how this company got started and their propagation and breeding efforts and their collections, which are so coveted. Welcome, David.
Hello, Michael.
Michael, I'm sorry. I was thinking David Austin. Welcome, Michael.
A lot of people make the same mistake.
I'm sorry. That must be irritating, I'm
sure.
Well,
the real David Austin, please stand.
So as a brief introduction, Michael Marriott has an amazing job. He's got the job that I would love to have. He has a degree in agricultural botany. He worked in the Pacific region growing rubber, coca, and oil palm. And he joined the David Austin Company in 1985, first as a nursery manager, then as technical manager, and also as rosarian. So he gives advice, he draws up rose garden plans, he writes, he lectures, and he promotes the nursery's breeding program. So in reading over the history of the company and how David Austin got started, we learned that the term English rose is kind of a made-up marketing term. Is that right, Michael?
Yes, I hesitate to say the marketing term, but if you say that to Dave Dawson, he would probably wouldn't like that at all.
Right.
It's sort of, he got his inspiration from the fact that there's Scottish roses, the Scots roses, which are hybrids of Rosa spinosissima, one of the wild roses we get over here in the UK. And he also got the French roses, the Gallica roses, uh-huh. which are hybrids of Rose Gallica, you know, one of the groups of the true old roses. And since roses are particularly associated with Great Britain and England, of course, then he thought, well, why not have a group of English roses as
right,
well?
Right.
And at the time when he sort of first thought up the term, it was when he just started off in the UK in 1969, and it was sort of quite a good term then because he didn't have any thoughts of it becoming international. But nowadays it gets a bit confusing, so often in the States and Australia and places like that, they call Austin roses rather than English roses, or David Austin's English roses or something like that.
Yes, right, and that's how we know them and how we refer to them. So tell our listeners about old roses versus new roses, and in particular the Constant Spry rose, which was your kind of frontsman.
Yes, well, the true old roses, they go back centuries, and so the earliest ones go back to sort of 12th, 13th century, something like that. It's sort of lost in mystery of time, really, mm-hmm. And they went right through until really the end of the 19th century. And some of them are fantastic roses, very beautiful. But the true old roses, the Gallicas and Damasks and things like that, Albers, they only flower once. They don't have any repeat flowering. So you're just talking now about, you know, going out just in sort of November and picking roses off your bushes. The old roses have the one flush of flowers sort of in about June, July time, wherever you live in the world.
Mm-hmm.
And then that's it, no more.
Mm-hmm.
And then they also have a very narrow color range, so you only got white, pink, and purple. You don't have true crimson, and you certainly don't have any yellows and apricots. So once flowering and a very narrow color range. And then, of course, if you contrast that to the modern roses that everybody's used to, then they repeat flower, and they'll start in New York, they'll start at June time and go right through until November, even December maybe. And there's the whole color range except for true blue.
Mm-hmm.
And so David, when he was a young man, he's 86 now. when he was a young man, he really didn't like the modern roses, the hybrid teas of his time.
Right.
And he got to hear about the true old roses, because in those days they were practically extinct. People were just sort of chucking them out, and people weren't interested in these old-fashioned roses that only flowered once. They wanted the newfangled modern hybrid teas with their wide color range and very distinctive flower shape. So he got hold of some of these true old roses and immediately fell in love with them. And he'd always been passionate, very interested in the breeding of new varieties of plants. Not new, and he was searching around for a plant to work on. And when he saw these true old roses, that's when the light bulb lit up in his head, and he thought, well, maybe I can work on these, trying to use the old roses as a basis, but try and make them repeat flowering and try and introduce a wider color range as well. And so that's what he did, and he started crossing the old roses and the new roses and developed his whole new group of what he called the English roses.
Mm-hmm.
And then Constance Spry was the very first one that he introduced. That was 1961, and that's in fact still only flowers once. So that's sort of like a precursor. And it wasn't until 1969 that he introduced a group of his first repeat flowering English roses. And things went on from that. And amazing story to tell from those early beginnings when he really struggled to start up the nursery and battled against the huge great nurseries at that time in the UK, things like people like Harkness and Wheatcroft and Friars and things like that.
Uh-huh.
To try and sort of compete against them was either incredibly stupid or incredibly brave.
Right. Well, when you love something, you know, the passion just takes hold.
Well, I'm personally enormously grateful that he did that, because there's a rose in my garden that blooms nonstop. The Prince, and I think that's one of yours. right?
That's right.
Yeah, that's right.
And talking about passion, I mean, that passion has held him through all, held him all the way through. And so even now at 86, he's totally passionate about his what he's doing, and an absolute believer and keeping going, developing the new varieties all the time. And so hopefully he'll keep going a very long time. So, you know, he's always got plans for the future. And he said, oh, just you wait until you see the new varieties I'll be introducing in the next three or four years. They'd be absolutely fantastic. They'd be really healthy and really beautiful. And so always looking forward to the future, always excited and always passionate about them.
So tell us quick I know that's a relative term, but tell our listeners how a rose comes to market. Like, you know, tell us a quick overview of the process.
Well, to actually produce a new variety, you have to cross two varieties. So you transfer the pollen from one variety and put it onto the stigma of another. And then the hips are produced, the seeds are produced inside, you harvest those, you sow them, they germinate fairly quickly, and usually by about April, you after sowing them in sort of January, February time, you see the first flowers in April, so very quick first flowering. And then it's a matter of choosing the most interesting ones over the years and the ones that are most beautiful and most reliable and most healthy as well. So we do it on a huge scale. We do something like 150,000, 160,000 crosses every year to produce in the region of 400,000 seeds. Those 400,000 seeds are sown one by one in a plug tray. That's what we're doing at the moment at the nursery. And we get about 200,000 seedlings every year from that. And those 200,000 seedlings are whittled down to about the 4, 5, 6 that we introduce at the Chelsea Flower Show. And that whole process takes about 8 or 9 years. And so we start off with the one plant of each seedling. Mm-hmm. And by the time we decide on the variety to be introduced, then we usually have about 15 or 20,000 of them.
So it takes... I've never grown roses from seed. I didn't realize that it's that quick. It will flower the first year after sowing?
That's right, yeah. So if it's a repeat flowering rose, then it flowers within literally 2 or 3 months of sowing. If it's a non-repeating variety, if it only flowers once, then it'll may take 2 or 3 years before it flowers. They all flower incredibly quickly. I mean, this is all in the greenhouse, but still, you know, they still grow very, very quickly.
That's very interesting.
So, Michael, then tell us, before we go to break, tell us about some Frankenflowers that you all have developed, right? Tell us some things that didn't work and why.
There's vast numbers. So you can imagine, out of 200,000 seedlings, we only introduced 5 or 6. And so 199,994, whatever, get chucked away every single year.
Right. And so there's more freaks.
There are just ones that maybe not very beautiful or just boring. Maybe they don't just look very good outside. Maybe they get dreadful disease. Mm-hmm. Or maybe they just don't work together as a plant. And what we're always after is not just beautiful flower, wonderful fragrance, good repeating, and great health. What we're looking for is all of those characters and the magical quality of charm
grace.
And beauty. You know, and that's what people really recognize. They really recognize charm in our Austin roses. And unfortunately, I think a lot of plants, not just roses, a lot of plants to introduce these days onto the market are completely charmless.
Yes. You know,
they're just novelties. They're bigger or smaller or brighter or bigger flowers or whatever. But in terms of beauty and charm, they score very, very badly, which is a great shame.
It is. It is. And that's what's so lovely about your catalog and why it's so such a peaceful pursuit in the middle of winter to imagine, you know, what these are going to smell like and look like in your garden. And the thing with these David Austin roses is that they're huge. They're like big cabbages, you know, with multiple
petals,
and they're just exquisite.
And it's nice to hear a company include charm
yeah.
as one of the
attributes
right. that they're looking for in a flower. Because you're right, a lot of it is just about novelty and
market and
some
commerce.
Weird, I mean, you know, we've seen it all. We deal with plants every day, and we have to select from the multitude of options each new season. And, you know, sometimes we find ourselves going back to so many of the tried and true because the old one, the new ones are just, you know, you kind of hit the nail on the head, charmless. Like, what were they thinking?
Right.
You know?
It's grotesque almost. It becomes.
Yeah.
Right.
And you start searching out for simpler forms, you know, things that are, you sometimes, Alice and I, find ourselves going back to the species because all the hybrids have become so weirdly deformed or out of character mm-hmm. with the original plant, you mm-hmm. know?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, there's so, you know, the thing that comes to mind immediately is some of these echinaceas that are introduced these days. They sort of look like zinnias, you know, but the, original echinacea is just such a beautiful plant.
Right.
You know, why mess around? Why try and make it look like a zinnia or something like that, you know?
That's a perfect analogy, exactly. Well, we have to take a break. Hang on to the line. We'll be right back in a few minutes. You're listening to We Dig Plants on the Heritage Radio Network.
Go in for understanding when you are away. Can't use my heart to think.
You're listening to Josephine by the Hollows on the Heritage Radio Network.org.
I will relate you and tie your finger right on up to mine. Sweet Josephine, you live in my dream. Sleep right by my side. I bid you well forever.
Today's program has been brought to you by Whole Foods Market. Washed rind cheeses are a fairly recent addition to the repertoires of artisanal cheesemakers in the United States. These cheeses tend to be stinkier than other types and are often high on the list of connoisseurs. Now, Whole Foods Market has come up with one of their own. The raw cow's milk cheese made by Sprout Creek Farm in Poughkeepsie, New York, is washed with 6-point ale from Red Hook, Brooklyn. The beige sticky rind deepens in color as it ages. The satiny ivory cheese within is mellow with a sweetly tangy bite and a grassy aroma. The current version features 6-point diesel, which is in limited supply, so stop by and pick up some before it's gone. And point of origin cheese is sold exclusively at Whole Foods Market in New York, Northern New Jersey, and Connecticut. For more information, visit WholeFoodsMarket.com.
I'm not one for consolation, never second best. I'll practice till I get you right, my dear. So know that I will love you and my.
Hi, welcome back to We Dig Plants on the Heritage Radio Network. Well, that was an appropriate song, Josephine. We were talking about roses with Michael Merritt of David Austin Roses, and we can't talk about roses without Empress Josephine, can we, Michael?
Michael?
No, that's right. She is the original collector of roses, and there's a pact saying that boats could go from England to France so they could especially transport roses across for her garden.
Right.
Malmaison, just outside Paris. So, yes, she's a great character in the rose world.
So, Michael, how did you tell us a little bit more in depth about your story? How did you come to work with the company, and how did you choose roses?
From rubber to roses.
Yeah, and were you just sick of the mosquitoes and the swamp to tropics?
The certainly the mosquitoes were really, really bad. I mean, the cocoa plantations especially, because I don't know if you can imagine what a cocoa pod looks like. It's sort of like two cups.
Yes.
And they split them open, take the beans out, and they just throw the cups on the ground. And so then it rains like mad all the time. And so they fill with water and perfect little breeding grounds for mosquitoes. And sometimes you go out into the plantations, and literally as soon as you got out of the car, you'd be mobbed by 10,000 mosquitoes. And it was just so bad, so you just get back in the car and go back to the office.
It's like worst job
awful.
Ever, right?
But I absolutely loved it. It was a great opportunity to see the world. Went to Borneo, Solomon Islands, and Papua New Guinea, and lived in those places for a year or 2 years each time. So it was a wonderful opportunity to stay in that part of the world. But when I came back to the UK, I didn't have a job. Had a young daughter. And searching around for a job to do, and through a contact to my wife, got a job at a nursery just outside London that grew bedding plants and roses. And for some reason, they told me to look after the roses, which I did for about 10 or 11 months, and then the job advert came up for David Austin Rose's, the nursery manager. So I applied, and on the basis of having worked at this Rose Nursery down in the South of England, he gave me the job. And I think partly because I think I have a sort of similar background to him. I come from a farming background, and always been absolutely passionate about plants and gardens ever since I was, well, you know, very, very young. Mm-hmm. And so David could see that, you know, that might be suitable material to help him on his nursery. But when I joined the nursery, that was 1985, it was still a tiny, tiny little nursery. We employed, I think, about 15 people, but nowadays we employ more like 160 people.
And you have...
And it was just, I joined exactly the right time, because just a couple of years beforehand, the most famous of all the Austin varieties had just been introduced, Graham Thomas.
Right.
And, of course, it was Graham Thomas, the rose that made the Austin roses famous, not only around the UK and Europe, but around the States, Australia, New Zealand, and Japan as well. So I joined exactly the right time, and a little bit more money was coming in, and more fame as well. And nowadays, of course, we're probably the best-known rose nursery in the world.
Right, exactly. And you also now have, you're in Tyler, Texas, is that right?
We've got an office there, and the roses are shipped nationwide from there. I come across 2-3 times a year. I've set up a number of trial gardens around the States to see how the different varieties grow in all the different climates. Because that's the great problem in the States, you know, the difference in climate between sort of San Diego and Alabama and right. and New York and over in Portland and in Des Moines or something like that is huge. And some varieties can cope very well with one climate and absolutely dreadful another climate. So what I do, I come across, I say, 2-3 times a year, inspecting my trial gardens and taking notes and finding out which are the best where, and so I can pass that on to gardeners all around the States.
So what's the best seller here in the States?
Probably at the moment it's a fantastic red variety called Munstead Wood. Most beautiful dark purpley red, beautiful flower shape, and lovely fragrance to go with it as well. Truly lovely rose.
Mm-hmm. How does it compare to the Prince? Do I need to give up my Prince, Michael?
It's more free flowering.
More?
Prince is lovely, but it's a bit sparse flower. It's not terribly generous with its flowers. But it's got a lovely fragrance too, and then it'd be healthier as well. So yeah, of the two, I'd prefer Munstead Wood.
I'm going to have to try that.
So what's the biggest market for the David Austin roses? Like, what country is the biggest purchaser?
Obviously in the UK we're the biggest here, but yes, the States would be the second biggest. Okay. Where we sell a lot of roses in the States. Yeah, there's an awful lot of you over there.
And I saw also that you all are now doing floral bouquets. You're right?
That's right. I think it's about 16, 17 years ago, had this idea that it would be good to try and breed some varieties of roses that look like the Austin roses, but that would be suitable for cutting, because people always love bringing our roses into their house and making arrangements, and they do look absolutely superb. But of course, they only have a fairly short vase life.
Mm-hmm.
And whereas the sort of traditional cut rose that you get for, you know, you buy for Valentine's Day and things like that, are really incredibly characterless. They sort of bred really for vase life, so they'll last 2 weeks or more in the vase, but they just sort of,
but they're boring,
nothing really. They've got,
well,
no,
they're foul.
They've got no character, no
they're
charm.
Foul. I'm sorry, I'm just gonna say it, they're foul. They roses foul. In fact, I've forbidden my husband to buy me any of those.
Right,
they're awful. They're just they're chemical laden, you know, and they have no grace. They really do.
No. So we started crossing the Austin roses of the traditional cut varieties, thinking it would be quite easy to introduce them. But about £2 million later and about 13 years, we finally introduced our first varieties. And they're becoming more and more popular now. Uh-huh. And they're very beautiful, lovely roses. So they're very much like the Austin roses, very double. got a certain, not hugely fragrant, but a certain amount of fragrance, and vase life of about sort of a week or 10 days or something like that. So not up to scratch of the other ones in terms of vase life, but, you know, do you really want a flower to last two weeks in your vase?
And also I think that there's some, you know, they're ephemeral. And it's a very different kind of business. And what's nice about the cuts is that you can now introduce the roses, of course, to people who don't have gardens.
Right.
Mm-hmm. You know, which is very, very nice.
New Yorkers.
Well, we use roses a lot in the gardens that we make in New York.
We use a lot of rugosas.
Rugosas. And our go-to variety is the fairy. That rose, Michael, is sort of, you know, when it's happy, it can take anything that New York can dish out.
Right. Yeah.
It's one of those, and I think it's an old variety too, right? It's from the 30s?
1930s, I think, yeah. Yes. I mean, it's, yes. I mean, the one thing, of course, it does lack is fragrance.
Yes. Right.
And, and I always think that, you know, a rose that is not fragrant is sort of somehow misses the point, really.
Yeah.
Because it's the first thing you do when you're confronted with a rose is you stick your nose into it.
Right.
And if there's no fragrance there, it's sort of a bit boring, really. But the rose, of course, is the most amazing plant from the point of view of fragrance. There's no other plant that has such a wide range of completely fragrance types as the rose.
Right.
So, you know, you smell a wallflower or a lilac or something like that, it has a very distinctive fragrance. But a rose can have five very different basic sorts of fragrances. The old rose fragrance, tea fragrance, musk, myrrh, and a whole range of different fruity fragrances as well. So absolutely fascinating. And it's something that I'm really passionate about. And, you know, whenever I get a rose, I'm always putting my nose into it to see what's there.
Right.
And try to identify it. And it's just really such a enjoyable thing to do. And, of course, it has a very basic effect on our brains. It's not just, oh, yes, that's a nice smell. The rose smell actually has a positive effect on our brains, makes us feel better. It calms us down, but it also makes us feel better as well. So the more you can smell the roses, the better.
Well, another question for you then is, are you all still searching for old roses?
There's more and more old roses. Well, not more and more. Gradually, old roses are coming to light, and I'm always on the lookout for a true old rose that might have passed me by and is right. worthy of introduction. They're often very difficult to find really good ones.
Mm-hmm.
You know, sometimes the disease resistance is very not very good, or that they don't cope with inclement weather.
Right.
Very well. And at the end of the day, unfortunately, just because a rose only, if an old rose only flowers once, then there's a limited market, which is a shame because, practically everything else in your garden flowers once, so why reject a rose, beautiful, beautiful rose that only flowers once? It's silly.
Mm-hmm. I read somewhere that a good place to hunt for roses is cemeteries, right?
Yeah.
That's old right, and down in the south they all have these rose rustlers that go around and try to identify them and propagate them if it's worthwhile. And they found some fantastic varieties that they haven't been able to put names to, and so they've just given local names. Yeah, it's fascinating. Unfortunately, very little of that in the UK, I think, because it's sort of, there's no tradition of planting roses in churchyard, or very little really. But when you go over to sort of places like Australia and New Zealand also, and you find some very interesting varieties out there. But it's also partly the climate, so a bit more of a challenging climate in the UK for varieties that are not so reliable, whereas if you've got a drier climate down south, then disease tends to be less of an issue and they survive better.
And also Northern California is fantastic for roses, right? The San Francisco area is probably prime area for rose growing and breeding.
That's right. Yes. It's there's lots of the states where it's a much better climate than ours. But then you have some very challenging areas. I mean, if you go down to the southeast, sort of Alabama, Georgia, Florida, then you've got the jolly Japanese beetle over there as well, which is. I'm so glad we don't have that over here.
Yeah. I think that's the nicest description I've ever heard.
And then the leafcutter bee, which is very popular in my garden, likes to visit my roses annually.
Well,
I actually like the leafcutter bee because he makes such a perfect incision into the leaf. Yeah. I just marvel at this sort of little semicircle of leaf that's missing.
And it doesn't, you know, it doesn't really seem to be affecting it. So it just sort of, you know,
yeah,
just does its thing and doesn't do so much damage that it's,
No.
Well, Michael, let's talk quickly. You mentioned the Chelsea Flower Show, which is kind of where you introduce the new varieties. Tell us about the Chelsea Flower Show, and then quickly tell us about your relationship with the Queen.
Isn't that a bit personal, Alice?
Not your particular. I'm saying with the David Austin Company.
All right, this is a G-rated show, so let's keep it clean, Michael. Carry on.
Just keep calm.
Chelsea is the arguably, well, I think everybody agrees, really, it's the best flower show in the world, and it's where all the world's press go, gardening press go, and all the best gardeners around the world go, and so it's where we introduce our new varieties each year. So we have a garden that is about, 30, 40 feet square, and we create a garden there and incorporate our new varieties. And then, according to what names we've decided, we often have somebody to launch them for us. And so that attracts quite a lot of press. And then that's on the Monday, and then everybody's kicked out at 3 o'clock on Monday afternoon, and then that's when the royal visitors are allowed to come in, so the Queen and various people like Prince Charles and Princess Alexandra of Kent and Princess Anne and Prince Edward and things like that. Mm-hmm. And so they come round, and sometimes they'll come and visit us and sometimes not. So, yes, the Queen comes around every sort of 3 or 4 years and has a chat with us. And then this year she didn't, but then we had Princess Anne, Prince Edward, and Princess Alexandra of Kent, and another royal who I couldn't name, actually. Yes, each came onto our stand and had to have a chat with them as well, all about roses. And they're amazing people. I mean, it's easy to ridicule them a little bit, but in fact, you've got to hold up your arms at them. They do a fantastic job to go around and talk to everybody in turn and talk sense to them. And
right.
I'm in greater admiration of the job they do around the world.
Well, I mean, you know, and horticulturally, you know, you can't have Kew Gardens without them. So it's, you
originally,
know,
yeah, without the support. So they kind of started it all.
That's right. They started that, was it 300 or 400 years ago or something like that, yeah. And there's been a great tradition in the royal family for supporting plants and gardens.
Right.
And, great yeah. for them, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Prince Charles is quite the gardener and gentleman farmer, isn't he?
Oh, Highgrove. I've never actually been to Highgrove, but apparently it's a most fantastic place and great supporter of organic gardening.
Yes, yeah.
And I've met him 3 or 4 times now. And, quite an amazing chap, actually. Quite amazing.
Well, I'm sorry, we have to end our show today. The 30 minutes is already up. We actually extended, because I feel like we could talk to you forever about roses. So the last question we have for you, Michael, is what is your favorite David Austin rose?
such an awful question.
If you want to ponder it, you can write it, think about it, and we can post it on our website.
Yeah.
If you want to think about it.
Okay. Well, I mean, I don't have a favorite at all, really, because I have lots of favorites.
Right, of
so,
course.
So, you know, there's things like Lady Emma Hamilton that has the most fantastic fragrance, or Gertrude Jekyll also has the most superb fragrance.
Gertrude Jekyll, right.
Munsted Wood. I had a Sceptred Isle, that's a superb rose that keeps on flowering, again, fantastic fragrance. So, you know, it's all the ones that have really superb fragrances, and even though they might not be the most reliable of all roses, they're still great favorites. They might suffer a bit from black spot or something like that, but, you know, you don't want to worry too much about these diseases, because, you know, we all suffer from ailments now and again, and we don't get chucked out just because we get a bit of a cold or a cough or something like that. So,
well, thank God, you know, for that.
Right, yeah.
It's worth persevering with varieties, looking after them a little bit better, and you know, if they've got great attributes like beautiful flowers and wonderful fragrance, then, you know, look after them and keep them in your garden.
Well, okay, one more question. What would you like to see for the future in the rose industry?
And you're not going to say a blue rose, because we know you're not going to, you're not working on that.
No, not at all, no.
Thank God.
No, it's just that combination of beautiful flower, fantastic fragrance, beautiful form, and perfect health as well. I mean, that would be the ideal. And do remember that, you know, a rose is not just something very double. I mean, the Austin rose, you were saying earlier on about very big double flowers, but in fact the great thing about the Austin rose is they're hugely variable. There's some which are just single with five petals,
yeah.
Some are semi-double, some are small flowers, some are large flowers, and they're all sorts of different shapes and sizes, and it makes it so much more interesting. So glory in that. Don't just limit yourself to the sort of the classic very double flowers. So yes, I want variety in my roses. I don't want them to all. That's what happened to the hybrid tea. They all ended up becoming very boring because they all look right. Rather similar.
The same shape, right.
Yeah, right. That's right. So
I know. Every time I see that.
Variety, you find the rose world.
Yeah.
Take advantage of those attributes. I have a feeling there's going to be a rose named Pippa sometime soon. What do you think, Michael?
Sounds like a nice name, yeah.
She is hot.
Yes. I'm thinking something crimson, multi-petaled, with a good fragrance.
I think it loses its petals and then gets them back. Within the same season.
That's right. Well, Michael, thank you so much for being on our show. You've been listening to We Dig Plants on the Heritage Radio Network. Please check out David Austin's catalog for some excellent rose porn. It gets us through the winter for sure. Thank you, Jack Inslee, for producing, and to Joe G for engineering. Have fun in the garden.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.